Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is A Lot to Learn with Austin Rogers. For the guy who knows everything, he's still got a lot to learn. Without further ado, here's Austin.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, good night. I have no idea what time it is because this is a podcast and you listen to podcasts whenever and wherever you are. Perhaps you might be in the middle of this South Atlantic on a sailboat right now, because that would be very apropos of tonight's guest, Mr. Reed Stowe. Reed, welcome.
Well, thank you. That's great. And you came to the gallery to meet me and see the art and do your show.
Right. We are down in Chelsea at the Paul Calandrillo Gallery on 28th Street between 10th and 11th Avenue. And for the next month up until approximately Halloween, Reed's exhibition will be up there. And it is spectacular. We're going to talk about the art in a bit. But first, we're going to talk about you, because you have an incredibly distinguished record, unheld by nearly anyone else on earth, or maybe anyone else? No,
not even close.
What is that record?
I set out from New York City with the intention of doing the longest sea voyage in history without stopping, without resupply. And I said, I'm going to go 1,000 days at sea and sail the oceans of the world and never stop or come to land.
3 years on the water, never resupplied. Your ship, your boat was stocked with what it needed for the entire voyage, and that was it.
That was it. I had to think of everything that I could possibly need to live, to eat, and to take care of the boat. And once I set off, that was it. I couldn't get anything else or go anywhere to get anything.
Those were the rules.
The rules came about in an interesting sort of way. About maybe 50 years ago, the first man to do a long sea voyage, he sailed around the world with one stop in Australia, Sir Francis Chichester. And when he arrived in England after 80 days at sea, Queen Elizabeth met him and the crowds came out and he was their national hero, and he only did 80 days. But that was the longest that anyone had ever gone.
80 days, and he was a national hero, you did that 10x over.
Yeah, Queen more did, than 10 times.
Queen didn't meet you, did she?
She didn't meet me, it was quite a surprise.
Describe this vessel for our listeners. Like, is it a big boat? Is it a little boat? Is it a sailboat?
It's a sailboat.
Yeah.
And so I grew up sailing, and my dad and granddad built boats, and I learned about boats when I was young. I sailed long voyages across the South Pacific when I was a teenager, and I built my first boat when I was 20 years old. And I learned how to navigate with a sextant. And I learned all the seamanship skills, boat building, sails, sewing, and everything. And then I went to sea and started sailing on my first boat, which is a very small catamaran. And while on that voyage, I started to realize that I never wanted to stop. I could always keep going, and I loved it being on the sea. So then I had to think, what would be the right type of boat that would allow me to go on the long sea voyage at sea. So I studied boat design, and I designed what I called the ultimate long-distance heavy weather sailboat. That means a boat that can go anywhere in the world and ride out the worst storms and keep going. And it had to be low-tech, because the modern boats need to be fixed in factories by skilled boatyard workers.
Right.
But my boat was an old-fashioned boat. I can rebuild my pulleys when they break. And I have short, solid trees as masts. So the boat is a gaff rig schooner, which is a very important boat in the history of American maritime. And the back of the Canadian Dime has a gaff rig schooner just like my boat. And so the schooners through the 1800s and early 1900s were the best designed and best sailing boats in the world. And they sailed everywhere up and down the coasts and in the rivers and hauling the cargoes. And they're the most important type of boat in the story of American sailing. And that was the design that I copied for my voyage. So it's not a modern racing boat. It's a real sturdy boat that can ride storms, and it has a big cargo hold that can carry a lot of fish or cargo, or for me, what I needed for my voyage.
That's uniquely American, and you sort of put like an American stamp on it, because what you just described there is I'm familiar with, you know, the maritime routes and, you know, the colonial history and how we plied our trade. And I really appreciate that you picked such a uniquely American boat and something such a utilitarian. You basically picked you picked an off-road vehicle. You picked the off-road vehicle / semi-truck. You didn't pick the Corvette or Ferrari, you pick the day-to-day work-a-day ship that for centuries would just be the commonplace thing that we'd see and never blink an eye at, and therefore it's the most practical for this purpose.
Yes, but at the same time, nothing's more romantic than a gaff rig schooner. And I saw my first gaff rig schooner as a very young child watching the TV show called Adventures in Paradise. So the gaff rig sailing across the sunset is a real symbol of the romance of the sea.
That's awesome. And I really like that as a New Yorker, occasionally we get lost at the fact that we are a maritime city founded on maritime power, both dual meaning maritime as the ocean and the harbor, but also the canals and the Great Lakes are all connected via New York. And these are sort of the same similar vessels that plied our New York waters. So I find it really great that was New York your Hoboken was your launch.
Well, that was only because the state park came into the west side of Manhattan, and they kicked everybody out that wasn't paying high dock fees. And I had my host on the Pier 63, the frying pan barge.
Yep.
He was my host, and he kept me there, and he kept fighting against them. Finally, they came with the police and said, "No, you can't stay here." In the state park, and they kicked me out right before I left. So I had to leave from Hoboken.
That is what a slap in the face. You couldn't leave from New York? Ah.
Yeah. You know, and I was, they did have another director of the state park, and he was watching me as I was preparing to go, and I was leaving the state park and doing historic voyages like the Odyssey of the Sea Turtle and other voyages like that. And he wrote me a letter and said, "It's so great to have you in our park. You bring charisma and character and color to our park." But the new state officials came in and they said, "Oh, no, you're not following all the rules. You can't pay the right amount of money. You can't live on your boat." And they proceeded to kick me off.
Oh, that's... Well, at least Hoboken got the glory then.
Yeah, but they hardly know it.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
They hardly know it.
And where did you return to New York?
I landed in New York, yeah.
Excellent. That's amazing. Go through, because I'm putting together my mind's eye of the hold of this vessel. What are you stocking with? 1,000 days of food, equipment, repairs, literally everything. What do I see when I open that hatch and I look down in the hold on day one?
Well, what you see is a whole bunch of boxes wrapped and taped in heavy plastic. Because whatever you bring on a boat, you've got to figure that there's a good chance it'll get wet, whether from water coming in from above, below, or through a hole or a crack. Even the best of boats find that they have leaks. So everything was wrapped up. So you basically saw a bunch of boxes that were in the hold.
And within them?
Within them was all of the food that myself and my partner, Sonia, needed for the whole voyage. And then, of course, there were piles of wood for repair, extra sails, piles of sails, and some other equipment like that.
And what was the cuisine? What was the Chez Reed experience?
Well, I'll tell you, it was gourmet because I had Cipriani's was one of my sponsors.
I love that.
So they gave me the best pastas and tomato sauces and olive paste and pesto and tomato sauces, all these fantastically fine food and a lot of it. And of course, I wrapped it up so that that nothing would happen to it, and I stored it in the boat. So I ate gourmet meals when I was at sea. But the basic food was rice and beans, all different kinds of rice, brown rice mostly, and all different kinds of beans, and oats, the best oats. And I had hundreds of pounds of every kind of dried fruit you can imagine. But the key to the diet and the most important part of it by far was that I grew sprouts.
You grew them.
I grew them. That meant that I had fresh living food every day, great big salads that were fantastic. Because I tried growing food on the boat. I tried doing it hydroponically.
That's what I was going to ask. Yeah.
What was going to be the fresh food? Growing food doesn't produce pounds of greenery to eat. Not compared to growing sprouts. When you grow sprouts, you soak them in water, and in a few days, you've got these living things that are most healthy and the only living food in the world that you might eat, because everything else has been chopped and it's been dead for a while, handled by who you know, you don't even know, going here and there. But a sprout is only touched by you, and if you're conscious and you're touching it with love and you're touching it with rainwater that falls from the sky, you're eating super healthy food, and I ate gourmet food, and I stayed healthy for all those 3 years. And when I got back, I told everyone, I said, I could have stayed another year at sea. I didn't come back because I needed food or water or anything, and I was healthy and strong. I came back because my partner was waiting for me on the shore with my 2-year-old son who I'd never seen.
That would be a pretty, that's an enormous personal sacrifice that you underwent for what some would say would be like, you know, a foolish, frivolous journey. Not me. I think it's awesome. But I could see a lot of outsiders being like, what, why? Just why? Why would you do this? Why would you put yourself under just this immense personal sacrifice and immense danger because you are on the high seas? And even your dietary restrictions are inherent dangers, as we know from, you know, centuries upon centuries of people not being able to sail for more than like a month before dying of malnutrition or some sort of scurvy-ish kind of thing. I mean, there's the old George Mallory, like, Sir Mallory, why are you climbing Everest? Because it's there, you know? Why, Reed? Why?
Well, it's a lot more than that. And you brought up a lot of things that I could talk about. But I just want to say that all my life, I've loved the ocean. And when I was a kid, I became ecstatic. I loved the ocean. And like I told you just a few minutes ago, when I went to sea, I loved it. There is something so extremely beautiful about sailing a boat across the ocean, and you're free. It's the only free place in the world. You see, wherever else you go, you need visas, passports, permission. And to me, that oppresses me. When I go on the sea, I don't ask for permission. I look at that open sea, and I say, yeah, and I'm prepared to go to sea, and I sail out, and I set my course, and I go anywhere I want to go in the world. And I'm free, and nobody tells me anything. And I'm in the most beautiful, pure place in nature. And I'm starting to have a lot of beautiful visions about how life is and how the universe is. And I'm having the greatest time. And so as I did that throughout my younger years, and I had good success, I went further and further. And I went to Antarctica in 86, long before anyone heard of it and before any other sailing yachts went there. I saw that as the ultimate challenge, but I said, what can I do next? And then I said, well, I'll just do the longest sea voyage in history. So it was what going to sea on the longest sea voyage in history was a process of my whole life doing what I love. And so that was what led me to it. Of course, I've had to look and say, well, what's good about that for humanity? Because as I'm empowered and I'm being given gifts at sea, I'm very well aware that I owe to give more than I get. And I really want to help humanity. I want to help the human race evolve. And so how has that helped the human race evolve? And it's only obvious that a society that doesn't have explorers and visionaries and people who go where no one's ever gone will deteriorate. And you need to have people who lead the way into the unknown of the human experience. And by doing that, we lift our spirits up and see a much larger life. And so that's a lot how I saw it.
That's a lot to unpack, and I love it. It's very spiritual and emotional, but also there's a very practical factor in that you did not do this willy-nilly. You are an accomplished lifelong sailor. This is not something that, you know, Joe from Minnesota can be like, I want to go do that. No, you are a professional, and this is your realm, and this is your expertise.
I always say, I'll speak about a lot of spiritual things because I use metaphysical techniques to help me do what I do. But I always say seamanship comes first. And so I described to you how I was young, how I was building boats, and how I was going to sea, and how I wanted to build the ultimate long-distance heavy weather sailboat. And I wanted to be the most seaworthy man. There's no man that can even come close to me. And there's a lot of men that are more skilled than I am. They're smarter than I am. They can build better boats. They can sail faster. But they can't spend but a very short time on the sea, a week. Why? Because they're afraid. So by doing what I did, I overcame the collective fears of mankind through the ages. And the men that are skillful now that that could be seaworthy, they can't leave for so long because they have to keep their money flow going. And they have to keep their security on land going. Because if you cut yourself, you leave the land, you leave that behind, you go out to sea, they all have to get back real quick. So they're really not seaworthy and their minds are really not visionary.
Right.
So I spent better part of my life becoming a seaman and cutting myself off from all the needs and wants of people in the world. So I cut every time something came up that wanted to hold me back, I let it go. So that when I left and I went to sea, I had no strings pulling me back. I was free to be at sea and tune into the nature, tune into the sea, understand what the sea was, what it demands, and how I can live on it.
Which is a perfect segue, because you were not doing nothing while at sea. We are right now surrounded by absolutely enormous works of art created by Reed at the gallery. And you were not idle. Your hands were not idle while you were at sea. Go through the process of what you're doing while you're, as you so poetically put, like following the rain and feeling the sun, yet you're inspired in this sort of metaphysical way to sort of start creating. What did you start creating?
Well, I'll say this. I've been an artist all my life, and my mom saved my art. And recently I found a box in the attic. And when I was 6 years old, I did a drawing that was 12 feet long, that had hundreds of men and boats, and the men were preparing the boats to go to sea and sailing them. And this is a drawing that I made that's 12 feet long when I was 6 years old. So I had an inborn somehow that I was loving the sea, and I was always creating art. So always created art over the years when I was sailing. But I wanted to say, when you first started asking me that question, for the first 2 years of the voyage, I didn't get to do any art.
Why?
I was working so hard to sail the boat and keep the boat under repair. It was so difficult to do. Just let me say that if it was easy, it's so beautiful and the ecstasy is so high, more people would do it. But it's very hard to sail a boat on the sea and keep her going because the sails wear out. I mean, one evening of improper alignment will wear a rope out and break it. How many ropes can you bring? And that's only what will happen in one evening. So keeping the boat seaworthy and keeping her going and handling those big sails, there's a certain great pleasure in it, but there's a lot of hard work. And after I was at sea for only a while, my sails started wearing out and tearing. If I had been rich or had a sponsor, I would have had some brand new sails and some extra sets, but because it didn't happen that way, I had old sails, and right away they started tearing. So I was sewing sails for 2 years, and I'm going to show you the stitches in the sails that I made.
I can't wait.
They're part of my art.
Excellent.
But so for 2 years, I was working to sail the boat. And finally, I got things under control, and I sailed around Cape Horn, and I said, man, I've done this toughest sailing that no one can imagine, and now I'm going to cool out a while because I'm a little tired. And I sit on the boat and a wave rocks me, and you got to hold on or you're going to be thrown across the boat. So I decided to count the waves, and I counted 1, 2, 3 each time I was getting rocked. And then I did the math and I said, geez, I'm getting rocked by 31,000 waves a day. How can the human body handle that? What's going to happen to my inner gyroscope? I didn't know I was going where.
No, I mean, you're an astronaut at this point.
I want to tell you about that too. That's another important, very important part of the voyage, because back in the late 80s, I realized that if we were going to go to Mars, that kind of astronauts they have now are not the right kind of people to sit in a spaceship for 3 years.
They're mariners.
I published a paper titled Seafarers of Today Provide a Role Model for Spacefarers of Tomorrow in 1990 in the National Space Magazine. And then I started speaking in space conferences about our space analogous voyage and how by being isolated at sea without seeing land or other people in a dangerous environment where I could die. How was I going to adapt to that and keep going? Because that's what someone who's going to Mars is going to have to do. So the psychology that I had, my power of conviction that I was going to stay out there and keep going is something that the astronauts of the future who go to Mars, they'll want to study and know about me. And of course, I can teach them, but they might not go anytime soon. But the whole thing of being on a boat at sea is like being in a spaceship in space. And in fact, I was working with the Natural History Museum, this planetarium, the premier planetarium in the world, had a 3D model of my schooner, and the main guy there, the genius there, Dr. Carter Emmert, was flying my schooner through space and teaching people about what we were doing, how it was leading the way for the human spirit going into space. And then he would call me up on a satellite telephone, and he'd know where I am because my position was satellite sent back. So he'd say, well, I can see where you are now, and you're having a beautiful sunset over there in the deep South Pacific. And then I would answer on the phone, and I'd say, yeah, everything's good out here. And then we'd have a conversation, and people would ask questions from the audience. So the whole space aspect and how my voyage is helping humans evolve off of this Earth has been a very important part of the whole voyage.
I mean, the analogy is cut and dried for me. I mean, that first leap of the Vikings across the Atlantic, you know, in immensely seaworthy, maneuverable, but open boat, and just be like, let's see what's that way. And then, you know, the age of discovery, the Da Gamas of the world and the Magellans of the world, let's see what's that way. Mm-hmm. It's the same sort of, you have to step off.
The known.
Yeah. And that step off is the same thing. I mean, I just said you're an astronaut sort of blithely. And then you're like, no, I am, which is amazing. And also the when you see these NASA tests and stuff like that, they'll like build the compound on a Hawaiian volcano or in a desert, and they'll concentrate on the living in Mars. But I think you're right. You know, the living in Mars part is obviously going to be really difficult, but the getting to Mars part is going to be really difficult. And confining oneself to a ship to have a daily routine of tasks, and you have to maintain it, and you have to maintain course, because what are we going to do? We're not just going to send people up in a capsule and just have them sit there and atrophy for three years as it takes. I don't know how long it takes to get to Mars, but have them atrophy for months upon months as they get to Mars, because they're going to have duties and stuff like that. So what you had to do on the daily is completely analogous to what someone would have to do in a long distance spacecraft.
Yeah. Mine was a space analogous voyage at sea. They have other space analogous tests, like you said, in Hawaii, in a capsule in Moscow, and in different places. But the main difference I draw is, when I saw they were going into a capsule in Moscow and they were going to make $100,000 each when they got out after 6 months, I was going, put me in there, because that looks easy to me. Put me over in Hawaii, easy. But you see, they were never living in an environment where they had to perform hard to stay alive, and they were never living in an environment that was
hostile,
and that they could die. So then the psychology is completely different. They can have their little fusses together, but they're not really living knowing that they could die with one mistake, or nature could overwhelm them like it would in a spaceship. So I lived in a state, I had to overcome fear from the first moment I set out. So they don't have to do that. So how can their psychology compare with what it's going to be like in a spaceship? Because when you get sent on that spaceship to Mars, you know very well you could die. So you've got to overcome your fears of death. You don't have to in all the
probably other, not coming other, back also.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So you have to overcome your fears of death, which you don't have to deal with in the other tests and the other training things they've set up now. But at sea, you do have to deal with living next to death. You know it's right next to you, and you know one mistake and you could die. And you also know that the sea mysteriously gobbles up the most seaworthy boats of man. So you're in a death environment, and you have to come to terms with that.
What we will get to the art, because it is fascinating art, and I love looking at it.
But art is tied into everything I'm saying.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I haven't been able to bring that out, but it is.
That's perfect, because I want to get into we will get to the art. But you're at death's door. No, death is at your door 24/7 on the high ocean, right? And as you said, you've psychologically prepared yourself for this. You know, you've got the stamina, the will, and the preparation, and the lifelong seamanship to tackle almost anything that the ocean can throw at you. But you must have seen some pretty hairy situations. I mean, what's that like, seeing that on the horizon? You know, you can see the weather systems moving in towards you and go, uh-oh, this is a thing. This is happening.
Yeah, there is a certain amount of scariness when you describe like the giant black cloud that's full of lightning, and you know a storm is coming and you're going to have to ride it out. But after many years of sailing my boat, I knew what my boat could do. I knew it could ride it out. So I was okay with that. And you would say, well, what is the scariest moment? You know, that I was in giant waves, especially down below and riding around Cape Horn. And those waves are so giant, and they have rogue waves where the bottom drops out of, and they turn over big boats. And sailboats are built to turn over and come back up again. They're like a steel submarine with a keel on the bottom with ballast in the keel.
Yep.
So I was turned upside down, and I was knocked over. But I was literally turned upside down so that if I didn't have my cargo secured, it would have all fallen on the ceiling and then gotten all jumbled up. So I had everything secured for that ultimate moment when I might get turned upside down.
You knew there was going to be a point that you would get turned upside down.
Yes, I had to know that. I had to know that. And I had, when I built the boat, I imagined that I was going to be in the worst storm possible. And everything I built on the boat was for that storm. Every little foothold, every little handhold, every little strap that was going to hold me in bed.
Irrelevant in any other situation other than that monster storm. So it's right. Just there. That is just there waiting for that eventuality. No use any normal calm day. Yep. But when that eventuality is, you're damn happy that that handle's there.
I prepared for that storm, and I was out there long enough and had enough storms that I really didn't have fear. Now, yes, there is lingering fear. When you are out at sea, you tune into nature and you become one with the nature. Well, that also implies that I become one with my fellow man, and that's more of a religious topic in a way. But I did have a feeling that I was at one with my fellow man, and so I'm having to overcome their fears constantly. They're not necessarily my individual things. I'm just a human. So I'm overcoming fear, even though I'm living there and I'm going, I've ridden it out, and I know I can do it, and I'm positive, and I'm not going to let fear bother me or bring me down or make me unhealthy. And on the other hand, I always told people that my ability to do the longest sea voyage in history and to depart the touch of the earth longer than any human ever has to do with my ability to handle pleasure, because I love it. I love it so much, and I have so much pleasure that the pleasure that flows through me now is incredible. If I couldn't handle that pleasure, I would quick pass out and go to sleep, but I can handle the pleasure and keep going. So handling the pleasure at sea was something that I learned how to do throughout my life. So I was there to handle the pleasure of being at sea, because let me tell you, when you're there and you're under the sun and the sea is all around you and the fish are swimming through your body and Ulysses is cheering me on, I'm having great pleasure. I'm having great ecstasy. And that was really what sustained me and helped me through the voyage, was my feeling of that pure pleasure and the love that I was feeling.
I guess I was trying to say, I don't get it, but then I do get it, because I used to do long distance hiking, and there would be miserable days of rain and patching your boots up and covered in mud and wet for days at a time. But then you rounded a corner and you came up and over a crest, and then the clouds broke, your clothes dried out in the sun, and then this vista just spreads in front of you, and you go, oh, that's why I hiked through the mud for four consecutive days, this exact moment. I get it now. I get it. I can see. And you get these little spiritual like moments when you commune with nature like that. And I can get the – understand what you're saying by not getting overwhelmed by the pleasure, because you're constantly looking at vistas that have never been seen by another man before.
That are beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's really beautiful out there in all its forms as it comes. And it's untouched and uninfluenced by man as far as I can see with my eye. I know there might be pollution down in the water. And I know there might be less albatross above me now than there was above Magellan, but to me it looks like pure nature, and it looks beautiful.
Okay, perfect. Now, how did this pure nature inform on your art? How did this ecstasy? Because I'm getting the feeling of, like, are you familiar with Hildegard von Bingen? She was a 12th, 13th century abbess and priestess and mystic. And she saw visions and she made paintings and she communed with nature and she made classical, not classical at that point, but she wrote music. And it's got this ephemeral mysticism, kind of old Christianity, you know, where it was like there was still paganism inside Christianity. It wasn't fully codified. And I'm not getting Christian, but you have this primal, I had a vision kind of thing going on in your art. And that's what I'm getting from it, just from meeting you and experiencing you. And I hope I'm not grossly wrong.
Well, yeah, very much so. In fact, I wanted to talk about something when you brought up the first Vikings to venture out into the unknown. And for me, when I built my first little boat when I was 20, I was going to cross the North Atlantic. It had no motor, no radio, no electricity. And it was a very small boat. And I was going to sail in the most primitive fashion. And I thought, well, what can I do to assure my survival? And I said, oh, yeah, I'll call the gods. I need to make figureheads. So I'd been an artist all my life, but when I started wood sculpting, it was a matter of life and death to me. I needed to do it to stay alive. And I tapped into the Vikings, because those men who did that would never have gone if they hadn't had a sea captain who was a shaman who made a dragon on the bow of that boat. And they looked at that dragon and they said, yeah, that dragon, he's going to take care of us. But that is the culture of every man on the sea. The Chinese had eyes. The Maoris had beautiful figureheads on their canoes. And so every man in culture through the ages always had figureheads and or eyes or some way that they were communicating with the gods to take care of them. So when I say that I actively do it, I wasn't making it up. Me, I was tapping into what they were doing, and I was having actual results from it where my figureheads were speaking to me, and they were helping me, and they were reassuring me. So my art became to empower me to do what I was doing at sea. So I spent my life sailing at sea, and I created this huge body of work, but I didn't really care about selling it or going into the art world or participating with society, because I thought, man, what I'm doing is so exciting that nothing equals the majesty of being on the sea longer than any human ever has. But I did it through the power of my art. The art helped me do it. So, and I'll give you a real good example of how I knew this at a very young age. There's a chart on a painting that before I crossed the North Atlantic, I drew myself on the other side saying, hooray, I made it. So I was using my art to program positive thoughts into my mind and program my future. So that's a lot how my art has been. It's been to help me do what I do. And I, rather than do something as graphic as what I just explained, I learned how to do things that were abstract that I knew were helping me at sea.
It's sort of totemic in a way, you know?
Yes.
I mean, and I'm just running through history of all the things that you just talked about. And like, you know, we name our cars, we name our airplanes, we, you know, we paint nose art on airplanes and during wartime and yes. Stuff like that. Without knowing it, you've touched upon it, or no, without us knowing it, you get it. You understand it. I think there's something innate that we have to do that kind of thing. We name our horses, we name our cars, and in that it gives them a sense of personalization, but really what we're trying to say is everything's going to be okay in this innately dangerous thing. Airplanes, cars, horses, locomotives, boats. These are all dangerous things where death is at the corner. So by naming it, we're like, oh, it's no longer boat, but, you know, she will protect me.
Right.
And I will have her have the figurehead on it so that the boat, to me, to nature conduit, is fulfilled. I've named the boat, therefore I'm connected to the boat, and then I put the figurehead on the boat so the boat can tell nature, don't mess with us, and now the triumvirate, the three of them are together as one. I'm getting really pokey and poetic right now.
Well, man has done this through the ages.
Yeah.
And so that's what I'm saying. That's what I did. And I took it passionately to the extremes so that I could say, yes, this art helped me accomplish what no man had ever conceived of and what yet no other man is capable of doing.
And that is a perfect note to take a quick break. We're going to take a break right here. And then when we come back with Reed, we're going to be standing by some of his paintings and we're going to talk about them. Sound good?
Okay.
All right. See you guys in just 1 minute.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
All right, welcome back. We are standing with Reed in front of one of his monumental works, which looks to be made out of fabric.
Yes, this is one of my sails, one of my most important sails from the voyage. And if you feel it, you'll see how thick and strong this material is.
What is this material?
This is layers of synthetic Dacron sails.
Okay.
Okay, these are the way sails are made in modern days.
Okay.
But look at this one. This one is an old-fashioned sail. So this sail might be 60 years old because look, it's made of natural fibers.
Uh-huh.
These are all hand stitches by the thousands. Hand stitch. So this was a very old sail that I got from an old boat that I painted on. This one's hand stitched. It's an old sail. I use modern sails because they're stronger and they're lighter. They're easier to put up. They last longer. And this sail was used on my boat for a few years. And at one point, I held this sail up in the middle of my boat for 6 months. And I say that this sail was flying in the wind consecutively longer than any sail in history.
Well, wow.
That's an odd thing to say.
But it's a great thing to say.
True, because what other boat was at sea for such a long time?
Or even if they were, what boat had the technology back in the day to maintain the sole same sail that duration?
They were never at sea that long.
Well, and also the materials of the time could not have lasted that long.
They could not have lasted that long.
But
they were never at sea that long.
This is a very accomplished sail.
This sail is a historic sail that was up longer than any sail in history.
I love that.
So, and because...
We're also doing something that is completely taboo, never do this, but I am with the artist, but I'm actually touching artwork, and this is giving me the heebie-jeebies as a lifelong art goer, where I'm like, don't touch, Reed is like, touch.
I really want you to touch.
I love it.
You'll feel the vibrations.
Yeah.
And you'll start to get the things that are in this sail, because now you've got salt on your fingers from Cape Horn. Because that salt was driven into the sail.
Right.
And so it carries with it all the experiences that it's had.
And
so
and,
it's more than just a beautiful visual object. It's three-dimensional, and it's actually fourth-dimensional in a way, because
it has experienced time.
With my eyes that see what isn't seen by normal people,
I see the vibrations of this painting go off the front and the back.
Well, you've also been here, intimately attached. This cell is literally your lifeline. This thing kept you alive.
There were certainly times when I was afraid, when I was pulling it, that I had to get it down in time before the wind was too much and the boat was going to tip over too much. It was going to break or whatever. But eventually what did happen was I was in a storm and the sail was already so old and worn out and shredded that I left it up, and I left it until the storm turned the sail into shreds, and I watched it tearing, and it was just a fantastic experience, and I knew that I was going to save it and make a painting on it.
Yeah.
And that's what I've done.
Good job, Sal. You did
Sal. Now you're going to live your life astounding people
who
look at you. And they're going to know part of this history because that's going to be the story that's going to come with the sale. So when they look at this piece, whether it's in a home or a museum or wherever, the story's going to go with it and people are going to understand the things that I'm telling you now.
I'm getting all choked up. And these ropes too, are these the actual practical ropes
there's different ropes on my sales that I've used myself also. And there is also collaged into this sail. You see this face?
Yes.
So that was a painting that I did at another time. This was a painting that I did.
Yes.
And so then I put in my artwork from other years are also on the sail. So the sail has a mixture of many things in it. So it's about the image that's in it. Yes, you can look back and you can see an image and you see images, but it's really also about the feeling and the texture and the abstract qualities that it has, because your eyes might look at it and you don't see anything. It looks like abstract colors and movement, but then you have to look a little closer to see that there are figures in it and there are other things happening. And I call this self-portrait on a crooked cross.
And there is the crooked cross.
There's the crooked cross, and there's the self-portrait of me hanging on it, sideways, kind of flying off.
Yep.
So it takes a while to see these things because of the feeling of the sail comes off. You see these rough ropes and these patterns of colors, and it takes a little while before then you see the figurative stuff in it and the stories that are with it, and then you look a little closer and you see, well, that might be a horizon, that might be the ocean in the background, that might be the sunset, but you don't see all of these things until you look for a while.
No, there's a lot to explore, and you're right, I would not have seen half the things unless I had the artist himself explaining what was happening, and I think it adds a fourth dimension to it, because now I'm imagining the time and I'm imagining this being up in the winds of the South Pacific or the North Atlantic and torn to shreds but still having its innate value.
And you said you imagined this being up. So it's like a being.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a being. It has its own presence, its own quality, its own life. It is animated.
And
it is a being.
Yeah. I've got an old pair of boots. I bet they'll never be able to be resold again. But I just can't throw them away. I just can't get rid of them.
Because they have the soul and the character.
Exactly.
If you were an artist, you'd put them in your art.
I was, but I'm not.
That's what I've done, because I can show you how I've taken torn sails and worn out material from the boat.
Well, I'm told that you did something that no one else had done before, which is you invented GPS art. You invented the practice. We've got people all over the world right now who go out for their daily runs or their walks or their bicycle rides, and they turn on their smartphone app that logs their miles and checks their calories, and they'll run and they'll spell "I love you, Cindy," or they'll draw, you know, a picture of a balloon dog. You did this decades ago.
Yeah.
You drew, and we are standing in front of another one of Reed's works, which has the actual charts that you used to navigate,
right.
And then you just started drawing at sea.
Well, when you speak about the fact that I invented GPS art, Before I left on the voyage, I was here in Manhattan preparing for the longest sea voyage in history. And I said, well, you know, I don't have enough food, I don't have any money, my motor's broken, but I gotta do a voyage, so I'm gonna just go 200 days. And on that 200 days, I'm gonna remind the world of the ancient wisdom of Aesop's fable, so I'm gonna draw a turtle out there. So I gave Associated Press my map with the turtle drawn on it. And here's a picture of it right here. Look down here and you can see the turtle. This is the Associated Press graphics. Here's South America and Africa, and between the two in the South Atlantic is the turtle drawing, the turtle that I gave them. And then they put the boat here and they said, well, here's where he's going to carry his food, here's the wind generator, how he's going to get his power, and the solar panels, and here's the living quarters on the boat, and here's how the sails are. And so the Associated Press did a big story about the first GPS art that was ever done. And at the time, I wasn't thinking that. I was just thinking, I'm going to go out to sea and draw a sea turtle so that I can try to help inspire and heal the world. I didn't realize at the time that I was doing something no one had ever done before. But that voyage informed many of my other voyages. And I intended on the 1,000-day voyage to draw beautiful things at sea with my course, but I was just sailing out of New York City, and in the middle of the night, I'm on watch, and I got my little coffee, and I'm in the pilot house, and my chart is there, and I'm looking all around, everything's beautiful, and I'm back, and I'm having a sip of my coffee, and suddenly we had a collision with a ship.
What? Right out of the harbor?
Only a few hundred miles out of New York City.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so when we hit the ship, the boat went bang, and I was knocked over, and I looked up, and I saw this scraping of this giant black wall going by the boat, and then it was by, and I was past.
And it was gone?
No, it went past me.
Yeah.
And then I shouted to Sonia, my partner, we've been hit by a ship. And then I said, you know, like, are we sinking? So I got my ship to shore radio, and I said, ship in the night, this is the schooner Anne. And they answered back, and I said, you just hit us. And they said, well, do you want us to rescue you? And I said, I don't know. Just a minute, wait, yeah. Don't leave yet, let me see if I'm sinking or not. So I checked my three compartments. I checked the motor room, which has floats and alarms, but no water was coming in. And I went out on deck. I had to be careful because the front of my boat hit the ship, so my bowsprit was broken off. So I lost 2 out of 4 sails. They were being blown backwards by the wind, so there were steel cables that had been broken off that were swinging around, and it was in the
dangerous.
Black of the night.
Yeah.
So it was kind of dangerous. But I crept around, and I looked at the boat, and I saw some scrapes along the side, but I didn't see any holes. And I looked again inside. I didn't see any holes, so we weren't sinking. So I called the ship back, and I said, well, we're not sinking, so I'm not abandoning ship. And we said goodbye in the night.
Did you ever find out who it was?
Yes, we found out who it was. And it was, I couldn't fight them at sea, but it was a big shipping company, Maersk Shipping.
Yep.
And they were denying it.
Yep.
And so that was just too bad for the little guy and a big, huge shipping company. And so, but anyway, I thought it was all over, and we were only out a few hundred miles, and I was fretting, and I was saying, it's all over for us after 20 years. Now the boat is smashed, we've lost our sails, the voyage is over. And my beautiful young partner, who had never been to sea before, she didn't freak out like I did. She looked at me and she said, but Reed, I thought you told me you could fix anything. And so
time to get to work.
So here was this courageous lady who said, yeah, get to work, fix this boat. We're setting out for 1,000 days. So that was what we did. And it took us a month. We drifted in the North Atlantic. The Gulf Stream took us out further at sea. We drifted for a month while I worked on the boat.
Oh, you just let it go.
Well, I couldn't do anything else.
Wow.
So we drifted for a month while I repaired the boat, enough to start sailing again. And basically, I had to wrap my chain around the bow of the boat and put it to shackles and put it on turnbuckles to hold the cables forward and keep the masts up straight. So I did the whole voyage with a disabled boat with chain wrapped around the bow of the boat. And when I did that, I lost one out of four sails. So that made the boat balance differently. It made it so the boat couldn't sail up against the wind as good. So I had to be very careful, because if I was too close to land somewhere and the wind was blowing on me, I wouldn't be able to sail my boat off the land. So I had to be very careful from then on. But the reason I brought this up at this very moment was because after that, I gave up my ideas for drawing art at sea.
Aha.
So then I knew I couldn't maneuver the boat. I couldn't do my art at sea. From now on, it was survival. We're going to keep going. We have to stay way out in the ocean, away from land, because we can't maneuver the boat. So we have to follow the winds and currents very skillfully to do the voyage.
But then you're going to paint something completely different, because you're going to be following nature's course.
That's exactly the truth. And now I'm going to show you. So when you look at this chart, what you
see...
We
are looking at a chart right now of the South Pacific.
South America.
Is ringed on the right with Cape Horn and South America's west coast, and then empty.
Yeah, okay. So I came sailing across the South Pacific.
Yep.
And by this time, my partner had to leave the boat. That's a whole nother story. So
we'll see if we can get to that.
But so I'm alone and I'm all sad and I'm running out of water. I haven't been able to catch rain and I'm wondering, what am I going to do? So I knew that if I sailed up to the equator, that's the best place in the world to catch rain, because mm-hmm. it rains a lot there. So I sailed up to the equator, which is here. And when I got to the equator, I said, well, where's the rain? I'm going to wait here. So I pulled down my sails. And then the current took me like this. And like this. And then another current took me back this way. And I said, well, whoa, there's the Galapagos Islands. I don't want to get any more near. So I raised my sails, and the wind took me back here and along here. And I sailed here. This is all quite a few days now.
Yep.
Oh, I did manage to catch the rain while I was up here drifting on the equator.
Yep.
So I filled up my water tanks. That was good. So now I'm sailing down, and then I'm looking down here, and I'm going, oh, there's Cape Horn. Well, it's wintertime down there now. It's going to be the worst storm. It's going to be freezing cold. I don't want to go down there now. So I turned around and started coming back up. And after a few weeks, when I got here, because my position was constantly plotted by satellite to verify the truth of the voyage.
Yes, and you're still navigating in the old time-tested ways, but this is your fail-safe.
Yeah, the GPS position device on the boat is verifying the voyage constantly.
Yes.
To the company who's built that machinery that monitors the Canadian fishing fleet.
Got it.
So they gave me the equipment. They're monitoring the voyage, and my friends put it up automatically on my website.
Right.
So at this point, I got an email from an old friend. He said, Reed, look at your chart, man. You've drawn a whale.
Yeah.
And I looked at the chart, and this whale was looking exactly like a whale that was on a wood carving on the boat next to my chart table. And I said, yeah, I've drawn a whale, and if I change course right now, I'll get the flipper,
I'll
slim the body down.
Yeah.
So even with a disabled boat, I was able to change course and draw the flipper and come up and draw the body. And when I got here, I said, well, I don't want too many lines to mess the whale up. So I sailed out on the same line
the
that
same
I sailed
route.
In
I see
on.
That. So you sailed into the whale on July 8th and you sailed out, is that October 25th?
Yeah, okay.
Wow.
So it's 5,000 miles in circumference.
Oh my God. And
it was drawn by nature, like
July,
you said.
Yeah, July, August, September, October, 4 months of time and 1,600 miles or whatever it is.
And I can tell you, when I drew the whale, my whole spirit changed. Because before that, I was fretting. I was out of water. I was lonely. Everything was breaking. I was sore from sewing sails all the time and sailing the boat. But when I drew the whale, I said, wow.
It did it for you.
Nature's speaking
yeah.
to me. And I know I'm going to be okay. I'm being taken care of. So after that, my spirit was, I know I can make it. And so I headed on south, and a month later I was going around Cape Horn. And that's all right here on this chart. And this is the original chart from the voyage. I can never do this again.
Nope.
And I can never replace this chart. And that's why this painting is so empowered and so incredible. And it has other stories on it like that. But this is the main story. This is my main chart. When I knew I had the opportunity to do this show in New York City, I said, okay, I'm giving it my very best. And that's my best.
Amazing. Well, we're going to wrap this up. Please tell everyone where they could follow you on Instagram and the Twitters and all the stuff. And tell them when they could come down to the gallery and check out your work.
Well, I'm sorry. I'm not a tech guy, so I'm not doing Instagram and Twitters.
Excellent. Please don't.
We do have a website that's called Beyond 1,000 Days. It's the stories of what's happened after the 1,000-day voyage. But if you just Google the longest sea voyage in history, that's me. Google the longest sea voyage in history, and there's tons of press, tons of stories, all kinds of stuff about the voyage. Now, my art show here in New York at 548 West 28th Street in the heart of the biggest art place in the world is going on at Paul Calandrillo Gallery, and it opens October the 3rd, that's tomorrow night, Thursday night from 6 to 9, and will be the opening for the show, and lots of our friends are coming and people who have heard about us and art lovers, and people will come and see the art that empowered and made possible the longest sea voyage in history.
Reed Stowe, this has been absolutely amazing. Thank you so much.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.